Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Stoa Nova Conversations. I am your host, Massimo Filucci from the City College of New York, and here's my co-host, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob, how are you doing?
I'm good, Massimo. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. This should be a good discussion.
I'm looking forward to it. Before we get to it, I'm going, as usual, to announce the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations, which will take place on Sunday, August 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And we will talk with Gretchen Radams-Sills on Musonius Rufus, one of the most prominent Stoics of the first century, and incidentally also Epictetus' teacher. If you want to register for that event, go to meetup.com and look up the Stoa Nova. And if you want to watch past episodes of the Stoa Nova Conversations, go to the Figs in Winter YouTube channel and look for our playlist. Now, today, it is my pleasure to introduce you to Nancy Sherman, who will be talking about, among other things, her new book, Stoic Wisdom, Ancient Lessons for Modern Resilience. Nancy is a university professor at Georgetown University and a Guggenheim Fellow. She holds a PhD from Harvard in ancient philosophy. An ethicist with research training in psychoanalysis, she lectures worldwide on ethics, the emotions, moral injury, and resilience. She's the author of After War, Oxford University Press, 2015, The Untold War, 2010, New York Times Editor's Pick, Stoic Warriors, also OUP, 2005, and then several other books on ancient and modern ethics, and as I said, most recently, Stoic Wisdom, Ancient Lessons for Modern Resilience. Nancy also served as the inaugural Distinguished Chair of Ethics at the United States Naval Academy. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much to be here, Massimo and Rob, and everyone in the audience. Thank you.
So I want to start with the book, although we can, our conversation can go in all sorts of directions. But you do begin the book with a chapter entitled "The Great Stoic Revival," and indeed there has been, or we are in the middle of, a Stoic revival of some sort. Why do you think that Stoicism is undergoing a revival? Why all this interest in Stoicism over the last decade, I would say, decade and a half, something like that? What's your hunch?
So, good question. A few things. One is there's always been, or has been, I don't know, since maybe Carnegie Dale, interest in self-help. So that market, if you like, is stable and probably growing. Second, the classics, as you know, Greco-Roman classicism, has always been a place to turn as an alternative or addition or supplement, more accessible sometimes than Eastern traditions of meditation, of tranquility, calm. So I think those are two good reasons. The third is, picking up on the idea of techniques or life hacks. I have to add about life hacks, my husband is probably the oldest data scientist alive, and even got a book, the original book from O'Reilly Press on hacking in 1991. And I said, is there a definition of life hack in there? And we went through the dictionary, is it a proper dictionary? And there wasn't. So that's a relatively new term out of Silicon Valley. It came out of a convention around 1992 or 91. Anyway, so, but the way of retailing that, I'll use that word advisedly, into a Greco-Roman slant through various folks, I think is part of the reason. I guess also, and as an ethicist, the understanding virtue from a Greek point of view, whether it's Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, someone I've spent a lot of time with, or the Stoics, is really of keen interest. So, and I think what's often not brought out is that the Stoics were prescient. They're really clairvoyant, I think, in understanding the emotions, not necessarily prescribing, but describing layers of emotions, emotional complexity. They have Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle beat. I mean, they surpass the greats, I think. And it takes, digging and understanding to figure it out. So I don't know if that's always rises to the top in the popular great revival, but in my mind, it's worth the revival. So I'd say what I would say, if they're worth reading, I'd say three things. One is that they do have a lot of interesting techniques, you might say, life hacks. I don't like the term that much, but I'll go with it. Really brilliant, I think, on the emotions, not again what we should do with them always, but what they are. And thirdly, they were the first real cosmopolitans. They didn't invent the term. Diogenes right. the Cynic did, but I'm a citizen of everywhere and nowhere. I'm a citizen without borders of the world, cosmos. But they had described that expanded global world that in which we share humanity, picked up by the Enlightenment as shared reason in terms of Immanuel Kant. 18th century. So those, I think those are all in the background. They don't always rise to the top, but they're the worthy bits that should rise to the top.
Yeah. And you open up a number of issues that I think we might, we'll go and come back to, but Rob, you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think you've sort of set the table nicely for us. I wanted to pick on the emotion thing a little bit, maybe to start. A lot of times we hear talk in what we might call modern or contemporary Stoicism of grit and resilience and ideas like that. And especially in your chapters 4 and 5 of this book, or lessons 4 and 5, talk about those ideas and how they relate to the theory of emotion a little bit. I wonder if you could maybe talk about that a little bit for us.
Sure. So a few things, excuse me, come up. Let maybe just lay that out for a sec. The Stoics really do think that you should try to control disabling emotions. And so some of those maybe Seneca especially talks about anger on anger. But also fear comes up all the time with Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius. But they have a few notions that are quite remarkable. So one is that you can regain composure a little bit if you put I'll use the phrase pause, but if you see the impulsive impression coming in and you don't immediately assent, it may take over you in an arousal, a pre-emotion, a proto-emotion, a kind of fast thinking, but you can put a pause in there, they think. So they're very volitional, like, you know, strong will. And then you can assess whether you're distorting or creating bias or unconscious kind of preconceptions. And they think there's two ways of responding. And that there's a first tier, which is essentially how you see the impression, and a second tier is how you behave. So it's kind of cognitive and behavioral, both elements. And those are aspects that I think are really quite brilliant to be able to separate that out. Now, grit is sometimes thought of as I do it all alone. It's, maybe Emerson, I don't know the whole tradition here, maybe Emerson picked up some of the Stoics and famously used the phrase self-reliance. But the Stoics were really about connection. At least, that is a strong, strong strand, often missed as an inflection point, but it is my inflection point for my conception of understanding the Stoics. And they think that, Marcus puts it well, if you've ever seen a battle, he's on the battlefield at the Danube in the Germanic campaigns, first century. If you've ever seen a body where the limbs are strewn apart, this from the trunk, this is what we make of ourselves when we disconnect from each other, when we forget that we belong to one another. And so that theme comes up over and over. For my mind, Seneca gives it best because he's always talking about the mentoring process and how we take care of each other through teaching. So grit and resilience on my read is really, I like to call it Stoic social grit. It requires the ways of connecting with others that help us even correct our biases, correct our presuppositions, overcome some fear, quiet our anger. And it's not go it alone, Marlboro man, kind of macho stuff. That's one aspect. For me, it really comes up sometimes in Seneca's tragedies. There may be dispute out there whether Seneca wrote them or not. I think they are original. And he has Hercules, who has this horrible, horrible tragedy. He finishes his 12 labors. He pierces through Hades. He comes into the world to reunite with his family, a real homecoming. Juno, always the stepmom, always jealous of this son of Jupiter's, who's probably, it was not hers, is going to do one bad deed again. And that is, she's going to blind him, a dissociation spell, and he kills his family, and he's suicidal. And Hercules wakes, and he figures out what happens, and he's ready to kill himself. And his father says, the guilt is not yours, it's your stepmother's. And his friend says, use your heroic, we can read Herculean, strength to find mercy. That's the perspective of the other helping you find your own strength. And I take those as critical in any walk of life. We don't go it alone. We lean on others, if you like that phrase, but we gain strength through each other. And I think that sociality, that's of course in Aristotle, or social animals, you know, self-sufficiency is relatedness. We are not self-sufficient without wife, children, spouse, family. That comes up in the Stoics in new ways, but not, it doesn't disappear. That's a beginning answer to your question.
Yeah, no, yeah. That makes perfect sense. And in fact, that gives me the opportunity to bring you back to something you already mentioned, the life hack aspect of modern Stoicism. And the reason for that is because, first of all, I take it that you are a little critical of the, at least reading your op-ed in the New York Times, for instance, recently. And I share that sort of caution, at the very least. There are some strands of modern Stoicism which are either there's this Silicon Valley Stoicism, you know, the one that is based on life hacks, and where we are told that people like Jeff Bezos are Stoics because they use some Stoic techniques. And I want to say, if there is anybody that is further away from the ideal of the Stoic sage, that probably is Jeff Bezos. On the one end, there is also another component, sort of another little branch that sometimes is referred to as Broicism, where these are people that are into the male rights, movement, and they are certainly not into community or anything like that. There's this ethos of masculinity and independence, and so both those, the Broics and the Silicon Valley Stoics, tend to ignore, it seems to me, what I think is actually the most important, or one of the most important components of Stoicism, which is this cosmopolitanism, which is this openness to the relationship. So what's your take? Now, that said, of course, there's nothing wrong with the techniques themselves. I mean, one of the things that one of the examples that analogies that I like to make when we talk about these things is like, look, Buddhists came up with several meditation techniques, but just because you meditate, that doesn't make you a Buddhist. What makes you a Buddhist is if you, endorse and absorb the philosophy itself, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path to Wisdom, and that sort of stuff. Then whether you meditate or not, it's actually not that important. Turns out a lot of Buddhists do not meditate. Now, that said, meditation per se, it's perfectly helpful for certain things like, dealing with chronic pain. But just because you meditate, you're not a Buddhist. And similarly, just because you write, your own philosophical journal or you do the Premeditatio Malorum or whatever it is, that doesn't make you a Stoic. So, but what's your take on the life hacking and all that sort of stuff?
That's great. Great intro. So I don't know exactly why life hacking caught on, whether it's Jack Dorsey taking an ice bath or walking without a coat. The funny phrase I heard once was I like to endure, sort of a Socrates image. So Stoic come via Socrates, walk in the barefoot and cold and all that. And so he says he walks back and forth to wherever Twitter is from his home in Mountain View or whatever. And someone in Toronto said, well, try a Toronto winter, sir.
Or perhaps a Wyoming winter.
There you go. Right.
So, it's picking up bits and pieces of managing life. For me, and you're quite right, I would even say there's a kind of toxic masculinity, a phrase that, again, is too popular, but part of the broism. That's not at all what I buy. I'm not quite sure how they come by it. I think it's what Rob was talking about before, the sort of a way of thinking about grit, which is very severe self-sufficiency or an exclusionary self-sufficiency, actually, of certain communities. The ancient ethics, no matter, and the Stoics did ethics, physics, and logic, so it's part of a larger picture. But I work in ethics. Ancient ethics from Socrates onward to the Hellenists, whether Stoic, Epicurean, a skeptic, and many other varieties in between, is always about virtue. It's a Latinized, Latinate word, but arete is even better, Greek, excellence, excellence of the psyche. And excellence of the psyche isn't about just me, some temperance, you know, that I don't have a gullet that's so long because I can flick, taste everything going down. That's Aristotle's joke there. But rather, it's about how I relate to others and uptake. And I think Seneca, who's one of my favorites, is just brilliant on this. In the De Beneficiis, on benefactions, on favors, often translated. Right. He and Cicero similarly, picking up on stuff as the go-between between the Greeks and the Romans, they talk a lot about emotional expression, giving a gift with a furrowed brow or grimace is like giving bread with stones. I mean, I wrote a paper years ago, 20 years ago at least, on the emotional expression in Seneca on benefits. And it's so brilliant. It's not just me showing it, thinking about the other and how it'll be picked up. They use two images. One is of a game of catch, that if you're throwing a ball, you got to think about the receiver. Like if I'm throwing a ball to my grandchild who I'm visiting, he's 3 years old. He comes up to my knees. I'm going to throw the ball to his knees or to my knees, you know, and we're going to be very gentle in whether he catches and how I get it, and very encouraging. If I'm throwing, you know, my husband knows I can't pitch and I can't hit, and he's got to be a little kind when he throws me a ball. They use that image of a game of catch, which is giving and taking in a reciprocal, mutually aware way. And it comes up again about the muses, the three graces. They are in a circle and they give one to another in a smooth, continuous flow. Those images of what's currently called uptake, you might say, emotional uptake, and I often write about emotional expression in some of my work, I think are central in the Stoics. That's not picked up at all in Life Hack, because Life Hacks, they're not interested in all the nuances that are the texture of social, as you say, cosmopolitan life, which runs through the fabric, the tissue, the social tissue is emotionally infused. And the Stoics, I think, are just brilliant on emotions. I just think they show us so many layers of emotions, from these quick arousals we can't easily control, but maybe can nip in the bud later so they don't blow into a temperament of rage, but maybe just your short fuse occasionally, to understanding the ordinary emotions. But as I think it's Seneca says, they outleap reason often. It's right. Like you're on a precipice and you fall on the precipice, you go down if you, you know, you got to catch yourself. To, you know, maybe we're never sages. No hagiography for me. I am not into saints here. Socrates wasn't a saint. Cato wasn't a saint. No one's a saint here. But we are always working on regulating our emotions, and in a very nuanced way. How I talk to my son is somewhat different from how I talk to my daughter, from how I talk to my husband, et cetera. It's just what it is to be in them. And they get that. I think Cicero even says, you know, he's grieving for the daughter, for his daughter Tullia dies in childbirth in Tusculans.
Tuscan Disputations, yes.
Yes. And he also in letters to Atticus, he is working so hard to contain his grief. He wants to get back to the forum. He's worried about his absence there. And he tries everything. And he says essentially that he may be able to control the demeanor, stop the tears, but he can't control the impression turned into a belief that it's a genuine loss. And if he did, he would be inhuman, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he also says, you know, I sort of know my audience a little bit. I know I have to control the outer, but I, for myself, I can keep the inner. It's a very moving, I think, explanation of the complexity of emotional experience and emotional expression, how they go together and how they come apart. That's a long answer. Well, it's not life hacks. Not life hacks.
Before Rob, I think, has the next question, but before we get there, let me just, this is about time to remind the audience that if you want to ask a question to Nancy, you can do so in the chat, or you can raise your virtual hand, not the real one, because we can't see everyone, the virtual hand, and then we will call on you in a few minutes. Rob, what's up with you?
Yeah. So I'd like to push in a perhaps less conciliatory manner with respect to modern Stoicism. And right, there's a point in the book where you say, and I'm going to quote here, that one of the point of the book is to turn the modern Stoic outward, realizing the promise of belonging in the world, connectedness, and shared reason in humanity. That sounds to me like kind of an indictment of modern Stoicism as you see it, right? But also it's got sort of an aspirational tone. And so I wondered if you could like maybe be some kind of specific about some ways in which you think that modern Stoicism is failing or fails to meet that challenge that you said.
Right.
And how it might turn to that.
That's great. Well, so one thing I just want to mention that I'm not in Washington, D.C. right now, but the Washington Post has a prominent piece that I wrote in the Outlook section called Five Myths. So it's a repeated piece, and this is Five Myths About Stoicism. So I mentioned that to the audience to get a take on some of that. I can't put it up in the chat at the moment. Anyway, I think the outer reach sometimes gets interpreted through indifference. I don't think the Stoics are talking about apathy, apatheia, or indifference. They have this brilliant view about indifference, TS, the Greek is ta adiaphora, and they are talking about external goods that are known in ancient philosophy, and they want you to have a different, I'll just sort of say, approach and avoidance behavior to them. So that you, so they're not sticky and acquisitive. You know, if you're a Freudian, you'd use the Greek word, or Strachey, James Strachey used the Greek word cathexis, and you hold on to it. or you don't, you know, you don't have this horrible fear, but rather you have the right kind of selection and avoidance. That somehow doesn't get picked up, but rather it sometimes often is accept and acquiesce in modern Stoicism. And accept and acquiesce the outer social world, to me, is morally unacceptable. I'll just come out with it. I don't endorse for, in my own interpretive works and in the ways in which I care to interact with the Stoics and teach the Stoics, a strand of them in which you retreat to an inner citadel. It can work at some times for extreme deprivation. Tad Brennan is, you know, talked about, a lot of people say, is Stoicism really just good for extreme deprivation situations? Maybe, certainly a way. But if anything has taught us this year and a half, it is we live in a global world. We, like it or not, we depend on others. And we depend on others in ways in which we can't accept, maybe sometimes you have to accept luck and make the best of it, but not every, not every downside is an opportunity. Many downsides are actually moments to not accept the downside and show personal strength, but to change the structure. And that's not often picked up in the life hack community. The life hack community is often about my individual strength, empowerment, anti-fragility, another phrase that I don't particularly like, and bulletproof is even worse in my mind. But it's rather changing certain social structures. And I think one of the ways I think this is answering your question, one of the ways you engage in the outer world is by understanding how you see the outer world. And if you see the outer world, as the Stoics would put it, in ways that have false values, their understanding, we may not agree with all of what they count as false values, but if you see the world out there with false values, then it is your job alone and with others to correct the way you see the world and to change some of the structures as best you can. So I take that very seriously. You know, I take in the book, I talk about policing, you know, I talk about other sorts of things where first impressions are sometimes impulsive impressions, and they are indications to us that it's time to see the world a little differently and change what we don't like. So if modern Stoicism is about accept and acquiesce, not my Stoicism.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree that there is this issue that, you know, people tend to put an emphasis on passages in the ancient Stoics where people like Epictetus say, you know, hold on, slow down, look at your impression, etc., with the implication that the impression is often wrong. But often doesn't mean all the time. Sometimes your impression is in fact correct, or at least it's telling you something on which you need to which you need to pay attention. So I think that Epictetus is right that our tendency is to go with our first impression, and those impressions are in fact often wrong. So, you know, cautioning people and advising temperance is fine, but that doesn't mean that therefore you should just constantly reject this stuff and retreat in the citadel. We have already several questions. Two people with the hands up. So we're gonna switch a little bit to the audience, and then Rob and I have at least a couple more questions that we'd like to ask you before the end of the hour. So Joseph, you were first. Go for it. Let me see. You can unmute yourself.
Yep. Yes. Hi. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, Ms. Sherman, and thank you, Massimo and Rob, for hosting. Really quickly, you've done a lot of work with PTSD. And specifically, how does Stoicism assist people in getting past their past traumas? And are there any specific practices that you've found to be especially useful, or is it just a case-by-case basis?
Thank you. Great question. Thank you so much, Joseph. So one of the things I talk about in the book that I think, I'll have two answers for you. One is, there's a lot of studies, I think it's the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, on pre-exposure to help mitigate trauma. And so that you are able to differentiate a little bit threats and have, I can't go into the details here about that, but I talk about it in, I think, calming anxiety, looking at a lot of literature. And that's a way that reminds me a bit of pre-rehearsal, of the Stoic notion of trying to anticipate or dwell in the future a little bit in order to be able to think about that. So that's not post, but pre-trauma, one thing to think about. A second thing that's a very much used technique at the VA and folks I know that I work with is on moral injury, treatment, moral healing. And one of the notions is that, say you have enormously disabling guilt for a collateral incident or a war that you feel is unjust and you're in conduct in that war or losing a buddy. And one of the techniques which resonates with Stoicism is that you switch perspectives. You bring an empty chair into a room with a compassionate moral authority, and you try to take up the perspective of that person and ask yourself, ask that person, would they hold you as unrelentlessly and unforgivingly or guilty or self-condemning as you do? That is like what I was talking about earlier when I mentioned Seneca's Hercules Rages, that particular passage of perspective switching. So I think you have to dig a little bit, and it's not an easy life hack, but if you're familiar with some of the current therapeutic techniques out there that are being used well, there's resonance. For my own purposes, I always say you know, your own journaling and self-help is critical, but there are so many different very experienced researchers and clinicians out there, and a relationship is the best in working through trauma. So that, no easy answer there. So those are some thoughts out there, but I go through some of it, especially I've done a lot of work on moral injury, and I would recommend After War and thinking about it, but also the chapters on that you mentioned, Rob, on the emotions and self-compassion in the face of moral injury.
Thank you, Nancy. So the next we're going to have a question from Greg live, and then Rob is going to pick one or two from the chat. So Greg, go ahead.
Thank you. So I'm curious, Dr. Sherman, if you could talk a little bit more about your approach to the book, because I'm 100% on board with what you're saying today, as well as your previous work that states that Stoicism really is about being pro-social. But the subtitle of your book involves resilience. And if you look at most of the lessons, they also focus on resilience, calm, peace of mind, those aspects of Stoicism, which you're kind of now talking about as being overemphasized compared to the pro-social stuff, which I agree with. So can you talk a little more about your thought process in structuring the lessons based on resilience and calm, as opposed to putting pro-sociality right up front in the lesson titles and the subtitle?
Oh, well, organizing a book is always a challenge. So I don't know, I could come up with a, a good answer for that.
Believe me, Nancy, Greg knows. He co-authored with me the Handbook for New Stoics.
And that's what
It was a challenge.
You know, you've got a lot of really critical things you want to think about, and you want to put it all together. I would just say, Greg, that I'm going to say something very radical. It's a dirty secret, but I have spent more years of my life with Aristotle than I have with my husband of grown children and grandchildren. So, so if you see an Aristotelian inflection, I fully own it. And I have lived and breathed with Aristotle most of my life. And he's always in one ear. So I did something with Zeke Emanuel a few weeks ago at Politics and Prose, and Zeke, for, you know, sort of said something to me that I had totally forgot. And that is, you know, he said, Nancy, you've been working most of your life on the emotions. I have. That has just been the focus of my interest since graduate school. So I have thought about emotions, interacting with others, interpersonality. I have a background in psychoanalysis. I think about that all the time. And when I read the text, that's there. So I can't speak for the organization, but I have always thought about Stoic social grit. And not in this particular book, but in other stuff that, well, I think it comes up in one of the chapters. I have talked a lot about cadre building, and I dance, I'm a modern dancer, and the way in which we talk to each other, if not through mirror neurons, that's a very disputed notion, but the way in which we synchronize, we're in sync or not in sync, picking up body cues. I think that is in the Stoics, and it's certainly part of their cosmopolitanism. Marcus is just so graphic about the cooperative endeavors and how you work together. And when you're not, if you're even when you're a sleeping partner, you're kind of working together. And I think that's there. So if it doesn't rise to the architectonic of the lessons, it is a constant theme. But I have to just say, Greg, too, I wrote this book during the pandemic. I was in isolation, away from my children, all my colleagues. I didn't even have the pleasure of teaching on Zoom. You know, I mean, it was serendipitous, but it was lonely. And I felt it very much. I also had lived in some fear. You know, I live right near the NIH. Our best friends were working on what, even early on long COVID, the moment COVID hit, they were working, she's a head of pulmonology, working on long COVID. I saw it up close, and I got all my protocols from them. And that just made me aware of the fact that I didn't feel like I was living in a very, stable environment at the moment. I think most of us were feeling this, even if we are privileged and don't have, you know, we're living in homes where we had space and not maybe weren't frontline workers. So that maybe answers it.
Thanks, Nancy. Rob, you want to pick one from the audience?
Yeah, I think I'd like to know what you have to say. Going a little more practical, but touching on where you just left off, I think Anne raises a nice question. She says, in a world in which the pandemic seems over for some, but still a huge threat for many, and a world also in which the wealth gap is even bigger than before, what sort of stoic advice do you have for people dealing with these situations?
That's great. Well, I think stoics are about engaging in the world and trying to change structures. I'm not a policy person, so I just have to say that up front, in the sense that I don't know the best equitable way to get the vaccines and good vaccines to India or Brazil. So I'm up front there, but I believe firmly that we have obligations to do that. I also believe firmly that the pandemic has shown us it is not over. We have no idea what the variants will look like. And most of us, especially if you've been in the medical world and you got vaccinated in December or January of last year, you're going to be ready for a booster very soon. And we don't know what that booster will look like. And it will depend on what's circulating globally. So cosmopolitanism is a multifaceted word, how Anthony Appiah uses it versus Martha Nussbaum versus me versus Massimo versus the Stoics is a disputed question. I do believe the getting out of the retreat mode of Stoicism and into the outward facing virtue mode and changing structures that are unacceptable here or elsewhere is an obligation. And if we can't see it in Stoicism, I have never been I'm not monotheistic, monophilosophic. I'll just be honest. When I finished Fabric of Character, Aristotle, I turned to Kant, it was in the air, and I had to make Kant talk to Aristotle. And I worked really hard on that. So I really do believe that we have many quivers, if that's the right word, arrows in our quiver, quivers in our arrow, arrows in our quiver, to be able to solve the world's problems as philosophers. And we should not hesitate to turn to public policy folks. They are our help here, enlightened public policy folks.
I'm going to pick up another question from the chat from Tobias. He says, you mentioned that to regain composure, you could use a pause and stop between trigger and response. I thought this is an idea of Viktor Frankl, that between the stimulus and response, there is a space and we have the power to choose how to respond. So where do the Stoics say things like that? And I guess I will add, what is the relationship between Stoicism and modern types of therapies like logotherapy, the one that was articulated by Frankl?
Well, let me begin in the beginning. The pause thing is really my picking up Seneca on Anger, book 2. That's the source. And that's what I cite in the book. He says that you have quick impressions, they come fast. The earlier Stoics actually say they hit you like that. And it's, you sometimes can grab them or not. And then and some you can't stop. And as you were saying earlier, Massimo, they're life-saving. They are adaptive. Others are maladaptive. And then you have moments in which to decide whether or not what you saw was correct and what you saw or and how to respond. Paralyze yourself, run, grab, go run for help, etc. How it relates precisely to specific logotherapy or whatnot, I can't say I'm honest about this. I don't know Frankl's method. I certainly know this, that talk therapy, of which the Stoics sort of are masters, I'd say they're babble, almost chatter discourse. Seneca's meditations at night are very, very discursive. It's not quieting the mind. It would keep me up all night if I had to go through the list of my missteps all day and who didn't sit me at the dais table when I should have been there, which is one of his beefs he has to work out, gives you a sense of where his head is. That's, that talk therapy is very psychoanalytic. Freud was reading the Greeks. and the Greco-Romans. So I can't, you know, in journaling, I don't know if that's not it plays in different therapies. So I can't tell you the whole line of therapies, but the idea of meditation as discursive is certainly an ancient Greco-Roman thing, and it is not an Eastern thing.
Yep. That's right. It's very distinct from the Eastern variety. In general, I think that typically when we talk about Stoicism and psychotherapy, we talk about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and
sure.
you know, and yep. things like that. And there's an interesting article by Don Robertson, where he actually does trace the different lineages of
right.
psychotherapy from the beginning of the 20th century. I think that he puts logotherapy and Viktor Frankl more into the existential therapy, branch. But that doesn't mean that there are no influences, and you know, that doesn't mean that they're not completely separate, completely distinct things.
I just want to say in that regard, Ellis and Beck, the founders of CBT, do quote Epictetus. Not a full blown discussion, but there's certainly aspects, and I mentioned before the appraisal idea as well as the behavioral idea.
Right. Mm-hmm. Rob.
Yep. So I'd like to go back to the ancients a little bit, right? That's my training, right? So I want to look at the, I'm just going to quote a little bit from the last paragraph of the main text of the book. You say, we've much to learn from the ancients, but we also have mistakes to avoid. Stoic discipline and resilience, virtue and the bonds of reason and rationality can help unite us to face our individual and shared challenges, but only when empathy and mercy course through the veins of reason. I really like that sentence. That is a way forward. It is a way forward as a healthy modern Stoic. So I'd like to start by asking you to maybe sort of articulate a little bit about what you take the mistakes of the ancients to be with respect to a healthy Stoicism, which is how I'm understanding what you've got there. And then bring it back to us today, how can we avoid those same mistakes, maybe in some detail?
Great. So one of the mistakes is thinking that slavery is just, and freedom is just a state of mind. I don't think enslavement is just a state of mind. And you know, this is a theme in Epictetus, of course, as an enslaved person. Seneca does a very complicated dance that I talk about in the book, in the letters. You know, it's mostly an apology for having a retinue of enslaved servants that is bigger than Dalton Abbey's ever was, you know, and also for not getting your enslaved people to be runaways. That was a big issue, fugitive slaves, and also to not excoriate you in courts. You know, you were trying to be on their better side, so it's a good idea to not scream at your enslaved person. Okay, that's a part of history, as with any of our reckoning with enslavement, that we, you know, that where history isn't always something that we need to adopt. We always have to be, you know, I'm a critical exegeticist. I'm a critical interpreter. Okay, that's one thing for sure. There's misogyny in the ancient world, and much more, deep misogyny. It's not to be embraced. I went to an all women's college. I believe the Naval Academy, all the academies, the forces, I think started admitting women, if I'm not sure, 1976. And leaders in integration much, much earlier, World War II. But there's deep misogyny. Musonius Rufus, who I know you're gonna talk about in an upcoming session, he is actually rather interesting. He says women have the same capacities for reason as men, and they should be able to be educated in the same way. They're welcome to my lectures, that sort of thing. Not always picked up by in modern, I'll slide to your second point, not always picked up in modern Stoicism, and certainly not in certain rabbit holes, if you want to go down there and Reddit and other sites that are very traditionally, you know, viewing a woman as a temptress or I mean, there's a misappropriation of classicism that's been long and deep, and I'd want to separate from that. So we talked one about enslavement, we talked one about misogyny. We also, retreat as opposed to, we're thinking of, this is a Socratic inheritance, thinking of things outside yourself as not to, your virtue and how you harm yourself is only what you do. And you may have a certain distance from what others do to you. You know, the good man can't be harmed because virtue is the only source of virtue, but you can be harmed by others and others can harm others. And I'll give you just an example that really stood out for me in this regard. And I think of him as a Stoic model. I interviewed many times a man named Hugh Thompson. He's not a household name. I've brought him to my classes. I brought him to the Naval Academy. He was the Vietnam helicopter pilot, Army warrant officer, who, circling over an area that we now know as My Lai, saw bodies. Let me back up. Early morning, circles over an area, quiet as can be, refuels. 2-3 hours later, circles over this area with his helicopter flying low, and he sees a ditch filled with what he thinks are bodies, but isn't sure. They were. And then he sees people being marched out. He stopped the massacre. The figure at that point was 300 persons. It could have been 600. The persons he stopped and gave this very, very controversial order to his side gunner, Larry Colburn: if the GIs shoot at me, shoot back. He was a haunted and hunted man for years, much of his post-Vietnam life. He saw the world and had to intervene to change it. He did it with an impetus of anger. That's often not a Stoic friendly emotion. Martha Nussbaum has gone back and forth on whether we should have or haven't Stoicism. It's a long dance. I argue in the book, maybe call it transitional anger, but whatever Hugh Thompson had, and I'll tell you 30 years afterwards, sitting in my office with tears in his eyes and said, "Professor Sherman, I'm gonna cry." I said, "Let's just stop talking if you can't." He said, "No, I have to tell the story." He still had the anger. He said, "What I saw out there was not what Americans do. It's what the Nazis did. I wasn't raised to see that." And it was anger that fed him. So a part of ancient Stoicism that needs to be tweaked, if you like, is what's the okay anger? I do think some moral outrage and righteous indignation, whatever you wanna call it, there's shades of it, are, I think Aristotle got that right, you know, that it has its place. And what you do with it is what matters. And I think he did the right thing at great cost, at terrific cost. So there we are. Enslavement, it's not just Misogyny. Find the passages. My husband loves the name Musonius Rufus. So he's had many limericks and puns and poems about Musonius. It's a great name. Read him more and see, you know, Martha Nussbaum has a great piece on Musonius. Read it and your guest coming up. Anger, let's have a robust conversation about disabling anger and anger that's out there. And fourthly, luck is not the same thing as as injustice. Bad luck that just happens, that you absolutely have no control over, is not the same thing as human inflicted harm. And I don't think the virtuous person should be self-sufficient such that harm that comes to them through injustice of others or that they see on behalf of others is something that they should just watch and say, "I'm still good because I didn't commit the harm." I don't know anyone that in the real world that operates that way. And it's not an ancient, it's not something that I think we should embrace in ancient philosophy.
All right, that's great. I had just a quick follow-up or two. I can certainly hear Aristotle in the background. That
wise man.
So there, it seems to me there's at least a couple of mistakes, or a couple of categories of mistakes that you've outlined, right? Some of them seem to be sort of like historic features of their historical and social context. But the others seem to be sort of real, maybe philosophical differences that you have with them. Do you think, so we might say, off the top of my head, it seems like the historical and cultural ones, like the slavery or some of the misogyny, we can just sort of dump. That's mm-hmm. easy. But mm-hmm. it's a little harder with the other ones. And is that sort of wrestling with that, is that some of the conversation you think that needs to be had?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me, I guess this really requires a little understanding of how I do history of philosophy, and it's very brief, but you know, that is my field, like your fields, and I love it, and I love texts. I teach it and try to get people into them. You know, go read the text and let's wrestle with the text hard. Yeah. And there are some parts of the texts that aren't just, as you say, contextually situated, but are part of the philosophy. And this, the Stoics inherited Socrates that, yep. you know, a good, no harm can come to a good person. And we know that's not necessarily the case. You know, Plato kind of struggled with it. He created a republic, right? He said, it's not just about TSD, what is it and what's my virtue? We need a social structure, and let's look at the soul writ small as reflected in the soul writ large. That's his, or psyche, that's his story. And then Zeno had the same thing. Let's have a republic. Zeno of Citium, the founder of Stoicism. Let's make a republic. We don't know exactly what that looked like because the texts aren't extant in full. But the social structure of living needs to be part there. Some of this is the Stoics had their hands so dirty, okay? They are so dirty. Seneca is dirty, I'll just be honest. He's a hero for me, but he's, you know, he's an accomplice to Nero. He's an apologist at times, you know? Kill Britannicus, I'll help you write on mercy. Kill your mother, she may have brought me out of Corsica, but you know, that's Agrippina, but here I am, I'll help you do this or that. So they're hemming and hawing. Get it, know it. As I say, when you do history of philosophy, it seems to me, and if you wanna have I don't like the idea of secular religion, it just rubs me the wrong way, but if you wanna critically engage and construct a viable philosophy, a viable psychotherapy, a viable approach that deals with the world in which you live in a most enlightened way. I think we fail ourselves as thinkers, as critical thinkers, as helping others, as parents and teachers, which we are, the three of us are teachers. If we are, I'll use the phrase, you know, strict literalists in any of this.
Right. No, I completely agree. I mean, this is actually, you guys have brought up many, many points of interesting points of conversation. I'm not going to have the time to comment on all of them, but this is exactly, this exchange you two have just had is exactly why people like Lawrence Baker, for instance, the author of A New Stoicism, argue that, hey, Stoicism needs to be updated. You know, the philosophy, there are, as Rob said, there are some things like slavery that you can just discard because they really don't stem out of the philosophy itself. After all, it's a cosmopolitan philosophy. So slavery and misogyny, in fact, don't really go well with a cosmopolitan philosophy. So you can chalk that out to, you know, the quirks of the time, in a sense, the culture of the time. But there are other things that may need more serious revision. And Baker pointed out that, you know, the funny thing about Stoicism, unlike, let's say, Buddhism, is that it did not evolve organically for 2.5 millennia. It was interrupted in the second or third century, and now we're restarted it basically in the 20th and 21st century. And so it's up to us to follow really Seneca's advice when he says to Lucilius, you know, the people that preceded us are now our masters. They're just our teachers. And
that's right.
If we discover new things, it's an important thing. Okay, let me close that comment there and ask you one more question before we run out of time completely. This is actually a pretty good follow-up, I think, on some of the things you just said. So as you know, recently I wrote an essay that is rather critical of a modern Stoic role model, James Stockdale. And he was captured, just for the audience, as a reminder, he was captured in Vietnam and endured 7 years as a POW. And he credited Epictetus for helping him make it through that ordeal. And it was a really horrible situation. And certainly Epictetus' advice helped Stockdale there. However, I suggest in that piece that there are ethical reasons to doubt that Stockdale should be considered a Stoic role model. Whether we want role models or not, that's another discussion. Given that he knew that the US was entering the war under false pretenses and yet stayed silent. He literally knew it. He was there when it happened, the famous second incident of the Tonkin base. He was actually there. So in general, specifically, what is your take about this particular episode, but more generally about the relationship between Stoicism and the military? Because it seems to me that Stoicism could play a pivotal role in getting a better military for our country and for any country. But at the same time, there is also the danger that the Stoicism might be in fact used by the military as yet another version of life hacks to make soldiers more resilient and less emotional, and that's it, without the ethical part. So what's your take on that?
Okay, terrific. I'll do it pretty quickly. I have had a lot of objections to both the soldiers' comprehensive soldier fitness program that Marty Seligman helped to found, but also part of my role in being at the Naval Academy and writing Stoic Warriors, an earlier book, was that the suck it up and truck on Stoicism was dangerous. It was absolutely dangerous. Earlier question about PTSD, it is not good to bury your feelings for 50 years. I've seen it, I lived with it. My father was a World War II veteran. If that's Stoicism, then I said, it's a curse. There are blessings of Stoicism, and don't pick the curses. So that's one thing, that use of Stoicism. Secondly, as I said earlier, and you sidebarred it, but yeah, role model hagiography is not my thing, nor should it be the, creation of saints should not necessarily be the military's way of proceeding with models. And Stockdale was made that way because I met Perot, Ross Perot, who brought him on as the vice president. It was a horrible pick, but it had to do with veneration of a military giant in his eyes. Bad mistake, as we all saw, those of us that are old enough to have watched the debate.
It didn't work out very well. Yeah.
look at YouTube if it's on YouTube.
Or the Saturday Night Live versions.
Right? Yes, that's right.
So there's a good example of your very point. Role models, pick them well.
Yeah.
Fourthly, just in terms of, I can't speak for the militarism. I mean, I work closely with the military, very, very closely. And I work closely in just war theory of returning veterans in the classroom at Georgetown, use postbellum justice after war, justice in war conduct, and reporters, major newspaper reporters who are my students or close colleagues who wrestle hard, and the photographers, war correspondent photographers, are wrestling very, very hard right now in Afghanistan, going back 13 years after they were in Helmand, and revisiting what they did and what we could do, and whether even if the missions began just, causes were just, they no longer were, and it was time to get out. So you can't buy any kind of philosophy and just slap it onto either moral health, psychological health, or character, or just war. Just war is so complicated. Our colleagues in philosophy have spent the past two or three decades dissecting a friend, Michael Walzer's work, essentially saying just conduct can't be said. This is Jeff McMahon, just conduct can't be separated from just war, because the how you fight and whether it's proportionate is relative to an end, and the end is the cause. This has just been the theme in philosophical discourse, not to get too philosophical about it, but that is what is on the minds of many of those I work with that are coming home. And not all, but some. And especially those that have had to return to Fallujah or are back now in Marja, rethinking this. This has been hard, you know, or people that advise the Joint Chiefs on these issues, you know, that are PhDs in philosophy, some of my PhDs. That are colonels and that teach at War College or at West Point is, or it's Naval Academy. This is really hard. So no philosophy, including the most elevated discussions of just war theory, jus ad bellum, laws of armed conflict, can help understand all the nuances of how an individual soldier, service member, veteran processes the contours of their war. We couldn't begin, but showing some, we do philosophy because we like to conceptually map the world a bit and think that some terms and distinctions help clarify the mess, the moral mess, but it is very untidy. And that's a long way of saying, I don't know, you know, I talked to Stockdale several times. I was one of the luckier ones to have interviewed him at length, visited him many times. I can't say how he viewed that. I know he feared that he was going to, the French papers were going to reveal that he was at Gulf of Tonkin, saw the second incident, and that he was going to suffer even harder than the 7.5 years he had. I know that was part of the conversation. Whether he thought fighting communism was a better thing than telling the truth and going, he didn't know what Johnson was going to use Gulf of Tonkin for. It's a long conversation about the Vietnam War. Yeah. The Gulf of Tonkin became the moment for building up troops and elevating the draft for people my age, some of our age, Massimo and me probably. So that long conversation, but I guess I would just say, as a philosopher and also, you know, a moral psychologist of sort, I don't think we should accept any religion, philosophy, set of tenets uncritically. Yes. It's just, that's, you know.
That seems like a great message to end this. Nancy, thank you so much for being with us today. This was a really interesting conversation, and you know, hopefully there'll be other occasions to have you come back and explore some of these themes more in detail.
I would love it. And I just want to thank you and the audience. It was just a wonderful conversation. So good to have practical questions, but that get into the texts as well and the complexities of, of talking about a text. And yes, go buy it if you haven't had it yet.
Yes, absolutely. All right, before closing, let me remind you that the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations with Rob and myself will take place on Sunday, August 1st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We will talk with Gretchen Radams-Schildz on Musonius Rufus. I said, we mentioned one of the most prominent Stoics of the first century and incidentally Epictetus's teacher. If you want to register for that event, go to meetup.com and look for Stoa Nova. And other than that, Rob, Nancy, see you soon and stay safe.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you very much, Nancy.